Hi, my name is John Light, and I've spent over 20 years working throughout all corners of the recruiting world. Our podcast, Drowning in the Tech Talent Pool, is a resource to help you stay afloat and get ahead of your competition. Hi, and welcome to another episode of Drowning in the Tech Talent Pool. Our guest today is Jacob Silber, and Jacob has an interesting background, and I'm going to ask you to kind of dive into that here in a moment, but you bootstrapped your current company, if I remember from our prior conversation correctly, in the data analytics and management space. So, I mean, I don't know a better place to start when it comes to background and what you do and what's brought us together. So why don't you take it away and share a little bit about your background and how you got to where you're at with Hermes Ventures.
Well, I'm going to start at the beginning, which was, you know, me on a hot August day stacking hay in the barn. And if you ever stacked hay in a barn on a hot August day, you'll know that it's not something you necessarily want to do for the rest of your life.
No, been there, done that myself.
So data is much easier to sling. It's easier to pick up, easier to put down. Really, the origin of me in the data space kind of goes back almost 20 years when big data wasn't even called big data. Mm-hmm. I was actually in a business school program at MIT and ended up doing work, what I call medium data. But all the tools that I learned there, which was really probability and statistics, just fundamental tools, nothing fancy, but a general understanding, I think that gave me the basis for getting into the space. And then fast forward probably about 7 years after that, when the internet was really starting to ramp up, early part of the last decade.
Right.
What I realized was that technology and tech talent was important. A business model was important if you're going to be a startup. But what was really the constraint driving almost everything was access to consumers. And that's what got me really interested in marketing, mm-hmm. digital marketing. I'm not going to say that you can do it without having a good tech team, though these days with AI and various other technologies, it's getting low code, no code. It's getting pretty close. Mm-hmm. But if you don't have access to customers and you don't know how to acquire customers, then you are going to be in real trouble. And that all really goes back to data, because it's basically how do you connect customers at the most cost-efficient method to your audience, you know, to your tool.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's actually really interesting. That's an interesting point, Jacob. Let me just throw this idea out there for a second. Most entrepreneurs, most startups, and I know in the industry sector I sit in the talent acquisition game, we have debates, you know, what came first, the chicken or the egg, the candidate or the client? You know, we've used for years, people in the contingent side of the game have at least have used candidates for years to gain access to clients. But the idea, I think, that how do you get the right audience engaged with your product, your service, your delivery side? I mean, that's an age old question. You know, I don't know that
it is.
We all struggle to crack that code.
But it's only gotten more challenging because the access to markets are just more limited, right? You have a few fairly large players in the space who are controlling the majority of the inventory. Mm-hmm. So I think that it ends up making the job almost even more important, because if you start looking at some of the big tech startups or the big startups in the last, say, 5 to 10 years, a big portion of their budget is going into marketing.
Yeah.
Consumer acquisition costs.
Yeah.
And so anyway, long story short, consumer acquisition, data, big data, that was really the origin story for Hermes.
My company, Sabretooth, we play in the tech space. And I know there's overlap between tech and IT. And so sometimes we have overlap as well, especially as it relates to what our tech talent does. But what got me into it, interestingly enough, was a search I did back in 2017 to where we needed what the client termed a big data analytics person to come in and run this very large direct advertising budget for a company that was looking to increase its footprint in the retail power space. And they needed somebody who could come in and get this data to speak to them, if I can put it that way, in as close to real time as possible, so that they could adjust, make micro and macro adjustments to how they were spending tens of millions of dollars a year in direct advertising. You know, what you're talking about getting to the customer is you got to get through the data. The data, you know, shows you how to do it in effect, and allows you to bring the customer closer to your delivery or your product. That somebody developing and bringing that expertise to the table, a search for that person, is what got me into the tech space as I see it today. You know, data science, machine learning, and all this, these other sorts of things. So I'm curious, both a talent and a business perspective, what has changed since you started Hermes to today, relative to what you can do and are expected to do and deliver with the data that you work in or work with?
That's a really interesting question. I think I'm gonna start it with an anecdote, which is, if you went back 20 years, I was actually in the IT industry. I was working as an engineer. Mm-hmm. And you said to me, what will change in the internet in 20 years from now? In terms of just the fundamental, core, basic, how the internet works. I would have been shocked if you told me that almost nothing has changed. I mean, it's really incredible, because really just how things run, I mean, yeah, there are a few layers on top of it. Mm-hmm. Email itself as a technology has not really changed that much in 40 years. I mean, that's hard to believe. I think that the big thing that's changed, and I might go back 10 years, actually, on this, just to talk about what's changed, is our ability to easily manipulate large amounts of data has gotten a lot easier. And that's no shock, right? The space I work in, which is primarily consumer data, is what I call medium data, because maybe we deal with a few billion rows of data, and maybe we move like a few hundred million a day. But if you look at programmatic advertising, we're talking about tens and maybe even hundreds of billions of rows of data a day. And
so much.
In order to do that, you really have multiple roles now. You don't have sort of one person who's running the database and they're doing the analysis and they're prepping the data for being analyzed. You know, those roles are split out now. So I think that's number one. And then number two, I think, is the rise of cloud computing has given any company really that wants it access to a lot of firepower in terms of data, mm-hmm. without necessarily having to have, at least from day one, the DevOps team to build that infrastructure mm-hmm. out.
Well, and that's a lower barrier to entry, right? For people like us.
It is. And so here I'm saying you need more people, but then the cloud computing services come in and give you that almost like a virtual core team. Things have changed kind of in multiple directions in terms of access, but also in terms of who you need.
Yeah. And well, that's, you know, when we look at data and we look at what's necessary today, where the barriers of entry are, what it takes to get from A to Z, I think the talent need is still there, but it's where the talent is needed, what it's doing, and how it's going about it has evolved. It's very interesting to hear you say what you said about email. And as soon as you said it, I'm like, oh, man, that makes total sense. I can't recall any generational leaps outside of a lot of companies and a lot of groups now, instead of using email, they use message boards, be it a Slack or a Discord or whatever it might be, to communicate. But email, I mean, we've gotten stronger, faster, more powerful, I suppose, and the ability to transmit and calculate things, to do analytics. But even in conjunction to email, it's like the core of how it works. It just is what it is. We just process it faster.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And I think if I were to go back when I got my first email account, probably a lot of people did in the 90s, not much has changed. The UI has maybe changed a little bit. How much data you can get in each email has changed a little bit. But there's a lot of technologies that are like that. Mm-hmm. People were using chat back in the 90s. I mean, yes, we have Slack now and the features are really great. But some things, you know, the more things change, the more they stay the same, which is people need to communicate.
Well, I mean, that's key. I remember a veteran I knew growing up would always said in conversation when he's talking about his time in the military, is like, it's rifles and radios. It's ability to communicate and coordinate what you're going to do, how you're going to execute things that make the biggest difference, in his opinion, from what he had experienced. But I'm curious, when you see these changes going on, you're talking about talent as well, and you're talking about bootstrapping something, you know, going from nothing or next to nothing into something that's significant, right? Something that's material, something, I don't know how many employees and contractors you guys have, but you're doing well. I know that you've had a lot of success with your customers, your clients out there. How do you approach being a more agile, more nimble, smaller, lighter on their feet kind of player in a marketplace? How do you approach getting the right talent and keeping it current? Because, you know, you look historically at American industry and, well, this group of talent isn't where they need to be. And you end up shedding a lot of people. You know, and now we seem to put more care and concern into upskilling and helping people develop their own careers. I'm curious, you know, what tact you all have taken and what are the pros and cons you've seen come from that tact?
I think my core strategy organizationally has been automate as soon as possible, but no sooner. And what that means is, in the context of our business, is we end up automating when it's a little painful. But we automate when it's painful because we know that the demand is there internally, and we can build without building redundant technology. And most companies, even if they're not technology companies, the technology staffing is a very big portion of their budget.
Yeah.
And building stuff that sits on a shelf is expensive from a multiple standpoints. First of all, it's expensive because you got to pay people to do the work and then it doesn't get used. Second, engineers don't like to build stuff that isn't going to be used. Figuring out that gap and figuring out, okay, we've had someone do this 20, 30 times in a row. We see the demand there. It's time to get our engineering team on turning this, productizing it, whether it's internal or external, is a really important balance. Mm-hmm. Along with all that, I think you have to push people to continue to try new technology, even if it's something you don't use. And I think that's a core piece of upskilling. So if I think back to the 80s, when we got our first home computer, there was a giant screw on the top of the computer. And depending on how far you turned it, it would either start up successfully or give you errors, which is kind of crazy when you think about it, right? I've managed to stay personally pretty current with technology because I'm a tinkerer. But if your team's not staying current with technology, that can be as big of a problem. So I think, you know, pushing people, even if people say, well, I want to do X, and that X is learning the new technology, sometimes they don't. And then there are people who want to learn every new piece of technology and not focus on sort of what's core to the business. So I think maybe that's the balance, you know, between people being comfortable in their roles, mm-hmm. and what I call shiny penny syndrome, where you're always chasing the new technology, even if it doesn't make business sense.
Yeah, I read a study recently, and just off the top of my head, I'm not recalling exactly where I read it, but to summarize what they had studied, they looked at specific job title descriptions from 5 years ago to current year. The one that jumped out at me is just your standard run-of-the-mill financial analyst. They said the actual job requirements description today is about 20% different than it was 5 years ago. You know, and we talk about...
That's not too bad, actually, 20%.
Yeah, but financial analyst. It's not a Python developer or, you know, somebody dealing in ML,
right,
or deep learning or whatever. It's a role that is pretty run-of-the-mill, and you expect it to be very repetitive and doing all this sort of thing, which I think actually makes it a prime target for AI and automation in respect to that. What struck me as interesting in reading that, well, wait a second. Okay, so they're doing 80% of what they did before plus this other 20% that came in from left field or wherever. What happened to that other 20%? That original 20% that was there, and now it's something else. An article didn't address that, but I've wondered about it because from an upskilling, staying current standpoint, how do you get somebody who's technically minded versus someone who maybe isn't technically minded to move ahead and be current with what technology allows them to do? You know, it's like,
see, you know, I'm in the tech industry when I said 20% in 5 years isn't bad.
Yeah.
Right?
Oh yeah.
I was like, oh, that's not, yeah, that's, that's nothing. The steel mill changes about 20% a year. So, I mean, it really, I think that's a perfect example about the difference and the spectrum of, to your point, how different things are in different industries. Mm-hmm. And really that the tech industry has come to just assume that in some ways things are going to be constantly changing. Mm-hmm. And that's not easy for everybody. That is not, you know, what we think of as a traditional job that doesn't change a lot. You come in, you do it, and you leave. Those jobs are being replaced. Probably with the exception of trades, where I feel like you can have a much more stable career because electrical codes don't change 20%.
Well, yet. And...
Or every
and
5 years.
Face it.
Well, actually, electrical codes do change probably 20% every 5 years.
Well, I mean, they do change. The flip side of that, when it comes to trades too, is most HVAC people are necessary where I live. You know, when it comes to your air conditioning and that sort of thing. Otherwise, I don't think Houston would nearly have the population that it does. Everybody had moved to Minnesota or Canada, even.
Yes.
You know, it's just too awful hot. And you know, what's funny is. And you hear the old cliche, it's not the heat, it's the humidity. Yeah, it's the heat. It gets pretty hot, but it's unbearable when all you can do is, even in the shade with a breeze on you, all you can do is sweat, you know? So you've got to have it to make it something that people want to live in. I kind of take things that are common and around me and try to relate them to what I see going on in the business world. And that's a prime example. You know, I do think there's going to be positions, like you said, in the trades that, to a great degree, might be accelerated. Maybe they have better scheduling software or applications or tools or whatever, things of that nature. And they have a just-in-time inventory system that's built right into their truck effectively. And every time they come in, they get what they need for the next day. And it's that part of it's automated. But getting out and interacting with a customer, putting a human face and a name and explaining what's wrong with an AC unit or a furnace or what's wrong with their vehicle and so on and so forth. Those are critical components. But the 20% or more of a job that's evolved out of that job, I think there's huge opportunity, you know, to automate, to apply AI, which has to be applied specifically, in my opinion. I think broad applications are getting gobbled up. ChatGPT just came out with some turbocharge tool over the weekend or the past few days that allows it to do a lot more, to have more in-the-box tools, I suppose, for their applications and building your own application. And we're rapidly, it seems like, moving away from these very broad AI applications to where this market, which I thought we were going anyway, to where very specific applications, very nuanced IP, if you will, functionality is going to rule the day for most people, especially.
Yeah, the area that gets me the most excited related to the trades is training. Because as we know, the average age of somebody in the trades is significantly above the average age of somebody of the general population. And what that means is that there's going to be a tremendous demand for jobs that, for the most part, technology isn't going to really be able to take over.
Right.
So I think what we're going to see is a continued increase in salaries and a continued increase in how do we train people quickly. And I think that that is going to be where technology plays in that space.
Yeah, it'd be a huge, huge play. How do we use it in our space, though? In your space? I mean, especially, you know, you're not Google or Amazon, right? You're not one of the big boys, like most of us aren't. So how can we leverage it in that respect for upskilling and keeping our people current and able to help lead us into the future?
Well, that's a good question from a skilling standpoint. Well, we, you know, when ChatGPT, I guess 3 or 4 came out, we got everybody in the company an account. And we did that not because I expect people to use it in their work, but I just wanted them to have access. Mm-hmm. And say, try it out. It's a tool. See if it has any application in your work. And some people will try it and some people won't. But if they don't have access, they're definitely not going to try it unless they're really, you know, what I would describe as a very motivated person.
Yeah.
We actually started using GPT to generate content for some aspects of our business. It's probably 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. So it would have been just when just GPT-3 came out, and people's jobs who were in operations, you know, they weren't writing articles. They were, how can I use this tool to accelerate content production? So still need human judgment, but what their job is changes quite a bit. So I think that's one piece of it, is that a lot of these new technologies, especially if they're being used by people who are motivated and excited by their job is they're going to be looking at ways to find a new job themselves. So that's, you know, that's sort of almost, I don't know how else to describe it, but you have to find a new job yourself in your company, outside of your company. If you're not moving, you're probably going backwards.
Well, you got to reinvent yourself, right? And that's, I think that's something a lot of people are afraid of. How do you do that? Take, for example, the number of people who go to college, they get a specific degree in whatever it might be, and 5 years later, 10 years later, they're not doing that anymore. I mean, I have an accounting degree. Not a
I have a degree in biology.
Yeah.
So and welcome to the club.
You're working with tech and data.
Don't do anything related to their degrees. Yeah.
I'm in a people business, you know, and it's basically professional services and advisory, running around helping my clients get very specific, very targeted, and nail what they're looking for every time. There's a science to it. There's an art to it. There's all this stuff. But at the same time, none of it's accounting.
Well, when I took my first accounting class, I thought it was art because I couldn't figure it out. So I'm going to give you I do understand it now, but I was taught by somebody who really understood it and was able to explain it to me. For whatever reason, in the classroom, I could not get.
Look, I had certain classes I struggled with mightily. And it's not because I think the information wasn't something you could grab onto. That's not it. But I think how we consume that information, the pace at which we consume it, you also have to practice it. You know, one of the things I noticed way back in the day when I did F&A recruiting is you'd have these candidates come out of the Big Four system as auditors. They'd have their CPA. They'd have 4 or 5 years experience. And man, they are ready to become the next controller of waste management or McDonald's or whatever. And you just look at them and you kind of have this, you know, you want to hide your head a little bit so you don't have to look at the profound lack of recognition that everybody needs reps. You need to have been around the block enough to understand what's coincidence and not what's not, what good looks like, what bad looks like, and how to manage people and build teams and manage workflows and processes. And we put a lot of effort into understanding those things and being able to lever those in our careers. And now we're at a point where potentially 3, 4, 5 years from now, maybe sooner, you know, hey, whatever the tool is, I need to design an internal process working with my existing organizational chart that gives us the most efficient route to produce our cues and our Ks, most efficient process, however you want to do it. And we're going to be posing questions of something, and something that we have to muddle our way through over the course of reporting cycle after reporting cycle is going away potentially. And compressing this formal education piece with, you know, you're no longer paying a price to learn all this other stuff that goes on top of your education, if that makes sense. And I just wonder where that's going to leave a lot of people.
There's a lot of things I want to respond to in that, because I think that was, you covered a lot of interesting ground. But the first thing is if you're going to college to learn something, you should be learning how to learn.
Yes.
That's the most important thing.
Absolutely.
Because the rapidity that our current economy is changing means that there are not going to be very comfortable jobs. It's just things are moving faster. And everyone observes it, how fast things seem to be moving. The ability to learn is the biggest differentiator. It doesn't matter what grade you get. If you can pick that up and you can say, I'm not afraid of what this new thing is. I know I'm going to fall on my face the first few times. I learned how to ice skate, hockey skate about a year ago, and I think I fell on my face and on the back of my head a couple of times, thankfully. So,
are you still walking today after doing that? I mean,
I'm not a spring chicken. But I was, you know, I was minorly afraid, but I wasn't terrified. And I think that approach to life, where you're just like, I got to learn. Someone's got to do it, and you know, if you screw up, you'll get better next time. So that I think is kind of number one, the big important thing that everyone should get out of college. But the second piece is getting reps. You can't throw a stone and find somebody under 30 who doesn't think that they should be C-level.
Yeah.
And then once you get over 30, you probably start to realize how impossibly many number of things you really need to learn in order to be effective, even at a mid-level management position.
Yeah. And there are exceptions. We all tend to look at the exceptions and think that's the rule versus the rule. And look, you could have the most talented 30-year-old or 40-year-old or whoever it is in the marketplace. They could be incredible. But time and chance happens to everyone, you know?
Yes. We focus on the lucky few rather than the normal, you know, rest of us. And it's not accurate.
No. And sometimes we wonder, how on earth did that happen?
If you flip dice enough time, you will get heads 100 times in a row. But it's just very low probability.
Yeah.
But one other thing that you said is, I think, is really important, which is a lot of the data work does end up being reps of, you know, what I would call high school math. Mm-hmm. Sometimes not even high school math. And so people get into the data space and they think that they're immediately going to have to learn every new AI algorithm that's come out.
Right.
But if you're a career changer, you're not going to be doing that. You're going to be pushing data. You're going to be pushing buttons. You're going to be learning how to turn the crank and make basic stuff happen. And so I think that should actually make people feel better. Of course, they got to go back and learn high school math again if they haven't been using
it.
But no. I'm just saying, you know, that could be a requirement. It's not even actually really high school math. I mean, most of the stuff people use is basic algebra.
Well, you know, you bring up a really, really good point about reps. And from a probabilistic standpoint, I have a client that is very data science centric. And part of the interview process is approaching a problem in the abstract, almost from an academic perspective to solve it. But then you put in other variables and take out certain variables and discuss the problem further with them because they want to get in your head a little bit and understand how you look at a problem, how you go about solving it. And what's interesting to me is there's usually somewhere in there, you know, you're focused on this one single instance of whatever. And then the question comes up, okay, well, what if you did it 1,000 times? Because when you start extending that and thinking about it in a different context, i.e. more reps, if it was just you and a pencil and paper and turning a page, doing a whatever solution, turning another page, doing the solution and so on and so forth to compare solutions, that could take forever. You'd need a whole team of people doing that. But with technology where it is, I drop that bad boy in a model, tell it to go run, and I can get 1,000 or 10,000 simulations. And I think the real issue isn't doing the simulation or even the math. The issue is how you set it up. You know, do the parameters get as close to the real thing as possible so that I get an answer I can do something with?
You know, I was just going to say, so if you say biology to data, I mean, what does a biologist do? Mm-hmm. Or certainly not one in undergrad. You know, you're basically trying to figure out the answers to problems that nobody knows the solution to. Mm-hmm. And I think that's just an approach. Yeah. It's a good approach to have because no matter if somebody at your work has an answer to a problem, you are going to hit a problem that nobody has an answer to, and you're going to have to figure out how to solve it.
Yeah, and if you know what the answer is, or you think you know, you become an easy victim for bias. We need to...
That's true, too.
We need to let the solution take us to the answer rather than the answer take us to what might be the solution. And that's a great way, I think, to approach bias in a lot of these situations. What do I know? I'm just a headhunter sitting over here chasing people around the world.
Well, you've got to make a matchmaker. You've got to make sure that, you know, two people are happy with each other, or at least one person's happy with a bunch of other people.
Yes, sir.
And vice versa.
So let me ask you this, Jacob, because it's an interest of mine. And one of the things I've found that's helped me a lot from the talent acquisition recruiting point of view, when I put that hat on, it's not enough to really dig in with somebody about, okay, tell me how work is, you know, tell me what you like and what you don't like. Let's understand your priorities, what you excel at. I also have found over the years, it's really nice to understand some things that may be a little more close to someone's heart, you know, what they're passionate about, you know, and it could be something that's work driven and work related. But I like to ask people, you know, before we get to a conclusion on these podcasts, you know, what are you passionate about? What's something that you've got going on and, you know, behind the scenes, so to speak, or even out in the open that really invigorates you and gives you energy to do the rest of life, you know, kind of recharges the batteries. What's that a bell ringer for you?
So completely outside of what I get from work and the aspects of that. Is that what you're talking about?
It could be. It can go either direction. Just top of mind. Talking about, hey, what is Jacob Silber passionate about that really, if you have a chance to do it, you do it. If it's a service project is service. If it's producing something that's great, if it's mentorship, if it's whatever it might be, maybe it's sending the elevator back down to help other people. And I tell you what, I've got a lot of respect for anybody bootstrapping a company, because if you can get past 4 or 5 years and at least have all the bills paid, you've got a real business. And it ain't easy. It's a heck of a lot of work. So I know you could have passion that's there, but you might have something too going on the personal side of things that, you know, you'd love to share with other people. And that's either direction, but whatever is that top of mind for you.
Well, I think my passion is tinkering. Mm-hmm. I kind of gone back to don't be afraid to fail. And so why did I learn how to ice skate? Well, I actually had no interest in ice skating, but my son decided that he wanted to play hockey. Uh-huh. And there were no hockey coaches. And so knowing nothing about hockey and knowing nothing about ice skating, I volunteered to be a hockey coach for a bunch of 9 and 10 year olds, which you can imagine are rambunctious.
Slightly.
put it a nice way. I think I just look for opportunities, whether I'm doing a volunteer activity or whether I'm just sitting around on a Saturday. What am I tinkering with? What am I playing with? What am I figuring out that I didn't know before? You're noticing a theme here, right? It's about lifelong learning.
Right.
It's not to say I don't sit around and watch TV. I do plenty of binging just like everybody else. But, you know, tinkering, coming up with an idea, testing it out, seeing if it works, seeing some success, seeing some failure. I think that's what I enjoy.
Well,
and, you know, that's what I've always enjoyed, I guess. So it's a lucky thing because it happens to be a useful skill in today's world.
Yeah.
But it's what I enjoy.
Hey, well,
and
if it works and resonates for you, that's huge in my opinion.
Yeah. It also means that I get up every morning knowing that there's always something for me to do, because there's no way I'm going to learn everything there is out there to learn in my lifetime.
Sounds to me like though you got a lot of catching up to do in the hockey world. So maybe that.
Well, I actually know what's happening in a hockey game really well now. So I can make a call before the ref does. So that's pretty good.
Well, so some of the refereeing we've seen
skating
lately,
is still,
that's no surprise.
Yeah. Yeah. Skating, on the other hand, I'm not so good at, but you know, we'll take, and I'm not going to be a ref either, because I've seen kids sports and yeah. Luckily we treat our refs pretty nice up here.
Yeah. So. Yeah, absolutely. Well, Jacob, thanks so much for joining us on Drowning in the Tech Talent Pool. I'll look forward to talking again, and I'll be very excited when we get to the point where we're dropping this episode out there, because you shared some great stuff. And I think the thing that resonates with me the most the whole conversation is pointing out the need for learning as a skill, that people should be developing the ability and the desire and the, I guess you could say, the strategy and tactics around learning, and not just, oh, I have to go do this or I have to go do that, but embrace it with a level of passion and interest and sincerity. Because let's face it, the time frame around job compression, so to speak, and a job changing or a role changing or career path needing to evolve is only accelerating. And if you're not learning, I don't know, I think you're going to have a lot of trouble, a lot of challenges, whether that's in a vocation or whether that's in tech or anywhere in between.
Yeah, plus it just makes life more fun. I mean, you know, you're not always going to have an opportunity to learn, but if you love learning, you're going to make an opportunity for yourself.
There you go. Jacob Silber, Hermes Ventures, thanks so much for joining us.
You've been listening to Drowning in the Tech Talent Pool. This podcast is sponsored by Sabretooth. Sabretooth improves the quality of hire and speeds up the time to fill specialized machine learning, data engineering, data science, and developer roles, stretching tech recruiting budgets further by bringing the precision of retained search and the speed of contingent search to the market in one complete solution. Find out more at sbr2th.com and follow me, John Light, on LinkedIn. Thanks for listening.